welcome to The Rest is Classified.
Today, we're telling the story of the Rainbow Warrior, a ship docked in Auckland, New Zealand, which meets a pretty terrible fate in an episode of sabotage, which I think it's fair to say goes desperately wrong. Let's start with Rainbow Warrior itself and the time. So we're in 1985. And it's the mid-80s. France is a nuclear power, and it's carrying out nuclear tests. And it carries these out in a place in the South Pacific called Mururoa. It's beautiful. I looked at some of the pictures of it. It's a kind of idyllic-looking atoll, not the kind of place you'd expect to be testing nuclear weapons and blowing up. But that's exactly what the French are doing there in this place, which is... To say it's in the middle of nowhere is wrong, because there are people and islands nearby, and that's part of the story. But the atoll itself is uninhabited, and it's, you know, it's 8,000 kilometers away from Australia, kind of halfway between, I guess, Australia and South America, but it's vital for the French. It's worth saying that for France, nuclear weapons are a kind of expression of sovereignty and power. I mean, they are for all nuclear weapon states, but I think particularly for the French, the idea that they have their own nuclear deterrence is very kind of central to French identity. So they take the weapons seriously, and they take the need to test them seriously. But set against them is this rather ragtag group of activists who are out to stop them, the protagonists of our story, which is Greenpeace. Set up in the 1970s, slightly kind of anarchic, lots of Save the Whale t-shirts, you know, and they're busy out there campaigning for, amongst other things, a nuclear-free Pacific and an end to these tests. And you know, they're building up their campaign. They're getting lots of publicity. There's already some bad blood between them and the French, because back in 1973, another vessel was rammed by a French minesweeper in international waters near Mururoa. And so Greenpeace are out to stop the tests and to get to Mururoa, and they want to lead a flotilla to basically kind of go where the test is going to happen and stop it happening.
I mean, and I think it is also worth mentioning just how much havoc the French tests have wreaked in the South Pacific. You know, the French conduct, over the span of what will end up being like 30 years, almost 200 nuclear tests in the South Pacific. I mean, they've blasted radioactive fallout over Samoa and Fiji. They've actually had islands and atolls so contaminated that they've had to be abandoned for 5-6 years at a time. And in one case, Gordon, they actually were trying to conduct an underground test. The bomb got stuck halfway down. They detonated it anyway, and it created an underwater landslide and a tsunami that killed a handful of people. So I think to some degree, I mean, it's understandable why you have Greenpeace, which I think had just been formed 10, 15 years prior, has really focused on the French and are really trying to stop and disrupt the French from conducting any more tests.
And at the heart of this is this ship, the Rainbow Warrior. Worth saying a little bit about the ship, because it's got a character of its own, I think. It was called the Sir William Hardy. So it was once a 49-meter old North Sea fisheries vessel built in the 50s for the British government. And Greenpeace had found it as a kind of rusting wreck in a basin in the East India docks in London. And they bought it for £40,000 in 1977 and then started working on it to turn it into what is their flagship, you know, painting rainbow colors on it. For them, it has its own symbolic importance, because it's the boat that they're going to take kind of round the world to carry out direct action, which is the Greenpeace way of doing things, to kind of get in the way of people doing whaling or sealing or nuclear tests. And so here we are in 1985, and the ship is heading for a big mission in the Pacific. On board are about a dozen or so people, a mix of nationalities, American, Swiss, German. Idealistic, I think, would be the way you might describe them. I think, you know, the captain himself calls them a bunch of crazy hippies. So I think that's the type, you know, people out to change the world, basically.
Set against the might of France, it really has an underdog feel even before we start talking about anything they're doing, just based off the way the ship looks.
And on board, there's a lot of partying and there's dancing. They're sleeping on deck under the stars, playing the saxophone. It seems from the accounts, the main thing they argued about was whether to bring plastic buckets along, whether plastic was a bad thing to bring along, and the kind of battles they had between the meat eaters and the vegans over what would get served. That was the kind of source of main tension. It's this summer of 1985. It's going to go around the Pacific Islands. It's first of all going to do a mission taking people away from islands which were actually contaminated by US nuclear tests, because both the US and UK also carried out nuclear tests back in the 50s. And then they're going to spend some time resupplying in New Zealand for a couple of weeks before then heading out to Mururoa to try and stop the test. And amongst those on board, rich collection of people. One of them, a kind of easygoing, mustachioed Portuguese photographer called Fernando Pereira, who's the one who's kind of taking pictures, because the idea is to publicize what they're doing, to get the information out to the outside world. But what they don't know is that the French have had enough. And this is how they're described. Greenpeace constituted in their eyes a kind of abominable synthesis of the forces of evil. Bearded environmentalists, often springing from leftist organizations and therefore part of the international subversion movement. They could only be wittingly or unwittingly KGB agents, while those of the movement's leaders who were of Anglo-Saxon origin clearly worked for US or British imperialism, with which the complicity of the Australian and New Zealand pacifist movement was seeking to sabotage the French nuclear defense effort. That's a kind of paranoid sense, which the KGB, the Brits, the Americans, everyone is kind of ganging up on the French and trying to push to undermine their nuclear deterrence, maybe to also spur the kind of independence movements in some of the French islands in this area. And that's the kind of mindset which has taken over in the French establishment. Charles Ernoux, the defense minister, is angry, and he basically wants Greenpeace and the Rainbow Warrior stopped. He wants to throw a punch, as someone puts it. So he turns to the DGSE.
La Direction Générale de la Sécurité Extérieure. There is a piece of slang for French spies calling them barbus. It directly translates as bearded ones, but I think the closest equivalent in English would be like spook, but it has this kind of derogatory connotation to it, that it's somebody who is deceitful, disguised, but not particularly clever. And I think it speaks a bit to, and we'll see some elements of this in the story, the fact that in the 80s, the DGSE, which by the way is pretty new at that point, it's been constituted out of a couple other security organizations in the early 80s, it's kind of a redheaded stepchild in the French establishment. It's not particularly trusted by the political elite, and it's not seen as the place you want to go if you've graduated from one of the grandes écoles in Paris. You know, you don't want to be a DGSE officer. And so I think the service has, at that point, a different vibe than CIA or MI6, where I think you've got some cachet. I think the French have more of a natural suspicion of kind of spies and secrecy, at least at that point. But it's a service, I mean, at least today, you know, what you'll hear from agency folks or from MI6 officers is it is, and I think it was then too, it's a highly capable service. I mean, you know, this is not traveling to Paris or anything like that. I mean, they're the kind of folks who are going to be in your hotel room, and it's a competent and well-regarded spy service.
And so maybe this is a good point to introduce Jean-Luc Quisterre. He, at this time, I guess he's emblematic of that. He'd joined as a military cadet age 17. So he is from that military background. His grandfather had fought in World War One and had told him about the Battle of Verdun and how he'd been gassed. And then his father had been forcibly drafted into the German army and taken prisoner at the Russian front. So kind of the military culture is part of his family, really, and his background. And he's joined the DGSE. He's a kind of young, sandy-haired, proud, patriotic young man. He's kind of motivated by a deep sense of patriotism, by fighting the Cold War, and about the sense of defending France. And he's ended up as a captain at this point in the combat dive team of the DGSE. And he's brought in at this point in 1985 and told that his mission is to deal with the Rainbow Warrior. And it's interesting because he seems to be cautious about it, at least from his recollections. But he's told, well, it's because it's been infiltrated by the KGB. And that seems to be the kind of way of convincing him, which I guess, you know, it's like, you know, I think we'll see that time and time again. Things are put through the lens of the Cold War often to justify them.
Is there some truth to it?
So I think what there's some truth to is that there were people in the French state who were convinced that Greenpeace had been infiltrated by the KGB and were being kind of backed by the KGB, and that was all part of a plan to stop France having its nuclear deterrent by pushing independence in the Pacific. But I don't think there's any truth in the sense that there was, you know, a KGB role. You know, there wasn't a KGB agent running the Rainbow Warrior and running that campaign. That's not true. But the perception, I think, you know, the feeling that there could be was something that might have been there in some parts of the French state. And certainly they seem to be using it with Jean-Luc Kister to try and persuade him, basically, because clearly he's a bit unsure about it, it seems, when it comes to dealing with this boat, because it is, after all, just a bunch of environmentalists.
I agree with you on the specifics of the Rainbow Warrior point. It's not like it was that boat or the people on it were specifically a front for the KGB, but it is true that there is kind of a broader, I guess, at this point in time, anti-nuclear movement that has real legs in Europe. I think even in the early to mid-80s in London, there were gigantic assemblies and protests of, you know, Londoners against nuclear weapons use or testing in you know, the British establishment. So like, you kind of have this, I think, bigger movement that the KGB is doubtless trying to influence and kind of shape, right? Even if it's not specifically running the Rainbow Warrior. I mean, it is true, I think. And it's, again, this is not to say that what happens next is justified or somehow, you know, targeted against actual Russian assets or anything like that. But it's got to be the case that, you know, that's right out of the KGB playbook to use an anti-nuclear movement that has legs in the West, try to feed it, nurture it, shape it. It's just sort of a classic KGB playbook of disinformation and misinformation and sort of influence operations, right?
Yeah. But then also those who are opposed to these anti-nuclear movements, it's a classic thing to go, well, this is kind of, it's all KGB and the whole thing is backed by the Soviets, and to try and use that to have a justification to often spy on these movements and act against it. So I think it's a mix of reasons with the French. And I think, you know, the kind of KGB stuff is really only part of it. I think there is actually a deeper animosity towards Greenpeace within the French state. It's really interesting because when they're looking at what to do, they don't want to just kind of contaminate the fuel and stop it sailing, you know, or kind of mess with the propellers. The plan that they come up with and what they call on Jean-Luc Kister to do is to, you know, to coin a phrase, stop the boat, is to sink it. They want it dealt with firmly, and that's the idea. And it's been quite an operation because they've worked out they need to know what the itinerary is of the Rainbow Warrior. So months before, they actually put a spy inside Greenpeace. So in New Zealand, in their office there, and it's a 33-year-old French woman turns up, who goes by the name Frédérique Bonlieu. So she arrives at the offices in Auckland, and she's got a letter of introduction from the London office of Greenpeace. And she said she's a scientist, but of course she's not. She's really Christine Cabon, an undercover DGSE officer. How's that? By one account, she'd been invalided out of a commando unit after a parachuting accident, joined the Secret Service and was a kind of specialist in deep undercover work and, you know, had infiltrated the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization in Lebanon, and then had plastic surgery. Now, those were the kind of exciting reports at the time about what she got up to. I'm not sure all of that may be true, though, but that was the kind of the sense of mystery that surrounded this woman. When actually, when you look at pictures of her, she just looks like a kind of 33-year-old scientist who's turned up at the offices. And her job there is to kind of work her way into Greenpeace. And she does that pretty effectively. And she, you know, she has occasionally some views, which I think some of the other Greenpeace people think are a little bit more, you know, conservative than maybe the traditional kind of bearded environmentalist activists who are around her, you know. So she's kind of not entirely against nuclear weapons, which, you know, in Greenpeace, you think is a bit of a giveaway.
This comes up in conversation with Greenpeace.
Someone remembers that afterwards, you know, and you think, maybe she didn't quite hide her views as well as she should have done.
Greenpeace counterintelligence has really dropped the ball in the story.
Yeah, their security department was not on it. And she manages to avoid being photographed, which is, you know, another telltale sign, you know, watch out for that. and says very little about her kind of personal life and where she's from. And she hangs around in the offices a lot and kind of has the chance to kind of rifle through the, you know, the drawers and the files, and is obviously collecting information there. And she also goes on some sightseeing trips up the coast of New Zealand. And what it looks like she's doing then is she's looking for spots where the undercover teams could later, you know, kind of land and kind of carry out some of their covert action. There's an element where, in hindsight, and it's always in hindsight, you know, you can see some of this activity is really suspicious. But she seems to be pretty effective. She gets the details. And then she leaves in May. So she's gone by the time, you know, the boat arrives in July. She says she's going to a conference about coral reefs in Tahiti. Very nice. And disappears. It means the DGSE know when the boat's coming. They know the plan for it. July it arrives. And it's supposed to be there for 2 weeks. And at this point, we also get the rest of the DGSE teams turn up. And it's worth, I think, you know, understanding a little bit about who they are and what they do. So there's one team who are posing as a Swiss honeymooning couple, and they're there to kind of do the support, I guess. You know, they're hiring the vans, they're going to kind of move things around, pick people up before and after the operation. And then a second team is the logistical team. Now, this is the team who are actually bringing in the explosives and bringing in the devices that are going to be used against Rainbow Warrior. And they have chartered a yacht. And it is a group of young French male DGSE officers who are going undercover on a yacht in the South Pacific. And it's fair to say that is not the worst operation you can imagine. And I think they also seem to enjoy it quite a lot.
Well, they just party, don't they, for several weeks while they're conducting recon. And I guess looking back on this now, with everything having been leaked, it looks absurd. But to, you know, put on my sort of DGSE apologist hat here for a second, which I will then remove in a few minutes, there is a world where you look at this and say it actually makes operational sense for them to be out there at clubs, kind of living it up a little bit, because that's what they are. They're tourists visiting New Zealand.
But hang on a sec. These photos of them, you know, some of them with their shirts off, these kind of strapping young men, and they're going around the bars and the bedrooms, it turns out, including at one point, the partner of a New Zealand policeman, I think.
Not a good look, yeah.
Which is not a good look. And, you know, getting their picture taken. And I mean, you know, that is going to get you noticed and get you remembered. But they're living it up while kind of bringing in the actual explosives. And then you have the third team. And the third team is really the dive team. And that is led by Jean-Luc Kister, who we met earlier, our military cadet from the DGSE. He's arriving, I think, 3 days before the dive is going to be taking place. And there's going to be two divers and then another person who's going to kind of pilot a Zodiac inflatable dinghy to carry out the actual attack. So by the evening of July 10th, everything is in place. Rainbow Warrior is there. Jean-Luc Kister and his colleagues have the explosives, having been delivered them from the party yacht, and they head out that evening for the dive. It's worth saying at this time, you know, it's July, but of course that's winter in the Southern Hemisphere, so it's dark already in the evening as they go out. It's cold. They are linked together as they kind of go off the dinghy by a strap about 1.5 meters long, the two divers, so that they can find each other, because they're going to be operating in total darkness and they can't use torches or anything else. And with them, they're carrying these limpet mines, which seem to have been specially made, I think, for the job.
It's basically a mine, an explosive that has a magnet on it and allows you to stick it to the bottom of a ship.
But they go down there, and Jean-Luc Kister kind of feels the hull. It's covered with small growths, kind of seaweed, seashells on it. One of them holds one of the bombs. The other fixes some kind of straps to kind of clamp and attach it to the Rainbow Warrior underwater. And once they've done that, they give the other one the thumbs up and set off the timer. It's currently about 8:50 p.m. and they program it for a 3-hour delay on the timer. And then they go and place the second bomb. Now, they plan to plant the first bomb port side, but then Kister has seen that there's another ship docked just next to the Rainbow Warrior, so he decides to put it on the starboard side. And they've decided to put two bombs on. And the idea seems to be that they thought the first bomb would go off, anyone who was on board would evacuate, and then the second one would sink the boat with a kind of after a short delay if there was anyone on board. And so they put these two bombs onto the boat and swim away at that point. Now, it's interesting because on board, there'd actually been a birthday party on the Rainbow Warrior that evening for one of the team. And I mean, at one point, one of the Greenpeace team, you know, recollect seeing something strange bobbing in the water that evening. And they go and take a look, and it's a floating bag of Brussels sprouts rather than a French Navy diver.
Was that a plastic bag, do you think? Or was it made out of something biodegradable?
I think in those days it'd be plastic. So, you know, there's been a party on the boat, but some of the Greenpeace, and there's about a dozen or so people normally on the boat, some of them go off into town for partying. Others go to bed. The divers have left. And so then 3 hours later, just before midnight, so at about 11:48, 11:49, the captain is woken by this enormous bang. And his initial instinct is that they've hit something. You know, he thinks they're at sea or, you know, something's happened and they've collided. And he looks out of the porthole and he sees that they're actually still at the dock and kind of goes, well, what's going on? Goes out into the corridor and 10 meters down the hall from him is the engine room. And he can already see water pouring into the engine room and it's filling up and it's actually hissing because the water that's coming into the engine room is hitting the kind of hot engine. And it's like the sound of an angry steam bath, someone says. And what's happened is a hole about 2 meters by 3 meters has been blown on the starboard side of the engine room. And I think what's notable is it's a bigger hole than had been expected by that bomb.
They didn't test it. Is that right?
Well, if they did test it, something different happened when they used it on the Rainbow Warrior. Now, because there's some reports claiming they'd run some tests of the dive, but perhaps they hadn't tested this exact bomb or against the kind of the hull of the Rainbow Warrior. But whatever it is, it was a more dramatic explosion than they expected. And shrapnel rips through the upper decks. And already things are kind of not going quite as they expected. And no one had been in the engine room or the upper decks when it went off. But still, already, this is kind of going south from the French plan. And then just a minute or two later, you get the second explosion.
Two thoughts on this. One is that in these kind of operations, you know, it seems like something always probably goes not according to plan and you sort of have to plan for that. So you would think, and I would think without getting into any specifics, just based off of some knowledge of how Western security services fabricate explosives today, I would have expected there to be a lot of testing if they're really serious about not killing anybody. And it doesn't seem like they did that.
No, I mean, Kiesler suggests that they hadn't really tested the bombs in that kind of environment. And that is one of the problems. And they don't seem to have accounted for the fact they hadn't left long between the two bombs. You know, by some accounts, it's just a minute, you know, for people who had been on board to get off. I mean, that seems, you know, in the chaos of what was happening, a pretty implausible amount of time, you know, for someone to wake up, work out what's going on and get off. I mean, maybe, but not guaranteed. And so some people are still on the boat. But then the second bomb goes off and the whole boat kind of jumps up at this second point. He shouts, abandon ship. But it's dark and the people who are still on there are kind of throwing on their clothes. No one's kind of really knows what's going on. And the boat is already starting to list and starting to kind of move onto its side. And it's sinking much faster than expected. Part of the idea of sinking it in the dock had been that it wouldn't completely sink. It's not like sinking it out in the ocean where people won't be able to get off. The French have thought about this a bit because they've thought, you know, we'll do it in the dock so we can sink the boat, but it'll kind of go halfway down. And people should be able to get off, but it's sinking faster than expected. So those who are still on board scramble onto the wharf, watch, you know, the Rainbow Warrior basically go down in 40 seconds or something like that. You know, a matter of seconds, it's going down. And at that point, they realize that someone's missing. And it's Fernando Pereira, the photographer on board the Rainbow Warrior.
Well, maybe there, Gordon, with the Rainbow Warrior at the bottom of Auckland Harbor, we should call it. And next time, we will get into the manhunt for the perpetrators of this bombing and really describe how it all unravels for the French intelligence service, the DGSE, on The Rest is Classified.
See you then.